Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise, informative update. It's Friday, the 7th of June. Coming up on the program, can a government of national unity work? How will the MK party fit into the process, if at all? Former CODESA negotiator Rolf Meyer on the art and pragmatism of political talks, the importance of community involvement in sustainable fishing, and the enduring success of the Comrades Marathon. The event takes place Sunday. As you are well aware, the top leadership of the African National Congress says it will seek to form a government of national unity with opposition groups after last week's election failed to produce an outright winner. I want to take a different approach to the story today as we begin the program and get some insight into how high-level political talks actually take place. A key player during the CODESA period in South Africa was Rolf Meyer, who joins me on the program now. So, Rolf, firstly, what is your first response then to last night's decision? And I'm wondering if you think if this is the best option.
I think so. I pondered on the subject during the course of the week, like all South Africans did. And obviously the choices were, like I could see it, three different options. And through the week, I came to the conclusion myself that the GNU, the Government of National Unity, might be the best option. For the sake of making it more inclusive, a coalition government of a form would have meant an agreement between two parties or maybe three or four. And others could have said, well, they have been excluded and then there's new contestation. So in this case, the GNU gives a better chance for a more inclusive approach. Of course, there will be some parties that might say they don't want to come to the party, but then it's their choice. So I think in general, and on the basis of how the president has laid it out in his statement last night, I think there's a solid base that can be formed. I would go along with that.
So, Rolf Meyer, let's look at the process now, if we can. There is a huge political settlement to negotiate. So, based on your experience in the past and at CODESA, where do you start something like this?
You know, there are many similarities, but also a lot of differences between the situation then and the process that we had to follow. I think we started off further away from each other in the 1990s than where the parties find themselves today. We had to learn to work together at that stage. It was not something that happened during apartheid times at all. And so there was no exposure to each other, and we started off, one can even say, as enemies. Now the guys and women are working together for a period of time in the same parliament at least, or in the same provincial administrations and legislatures, and they know each other, they know their positions, so I guess they can, on an easier basis, come together and start the process. The difficulties that exist is that they have very little time to iron out differences, and I feel for them about that, because it is great urgency. They have to consult with their constituencies or different party structures. That makes it difficult. It's not something that you can run over. And what it amounts to is that in the end, a government of national unity is something of a consensus government. So there has to be, the differences have to be addressed in such a way that there is maximum consensus, otherwise it can't work.
Again, Rolf Meyer, based on your experience, how did you convince others on your side when there was doubt in the room? Because it is inevitable that there is going to be increasing dissent within the ANC itself.
Yeah, I think not only in the ANC, probably in the DA as well. You know, I've spoken this week to both sides, people that I have access to, and you know, it's quite clear there are huge differences. I say both sides, I mean ANC and DA. I haven't spoken to other parties, but it's quite clear there are huge challenges that they will have to meet, undoubtedly so. To my mind, what I knew from my experience what worked is that you have to stress the alternative and how unacceptable that could be. You know, so and in the end, everybody has to run a risk. You can't pass that point. There will be risks to be run. There will be doubts. But I think the overall picture has to be painted in terms of what are the alternatives. And, of course, national interest has to come first. And I believe that is the approach that the parties that are seriously considering this will follow. I think the president made it very clear in his statement last night that national interest is the priority. So I think it's best to spell out, in other words, the unacceptability of the alternative and through that confront those supporters that might have second questions.
And Rolf Meyer, just a final question. How did you or how can the noise from outside, which is always there, be filtered or drowned out?
You will recall that we followed at that time a fairly open and transparent process, you know, and I think this is one of the tools that one can use under the current circumstances as well. And it's good that the parties are communicating their positions. That is how you keep people informed. And also, like the president was saying last night, if there is an agreement, it has to be made public, and everybody should be made accountable for what they're signing. And that is the best way to come to a solution. But Jeremy, I think it's also important to make this point about the need for developing good relations between those that will participate in the government jointly. You might differ on a lot of things, but if you have a good relationship with those that you differ from, you can actually, despite the differences, work together and find a way to go forward. That's the way to build trust. And I think, you know, whereas parties have in the past, those that will now participate in the government, sitting across the aisle from each other in parliament and fighting it out on a daily basis almost, they now have to suddenly reverse some of those positions, make compromises, take a different view on how to govern the country. But they can do so if they believe in each other and trust each other. Like I say, differences will not go away, but you can handle it.
Rolf Meyer, this conversation takes me back many, many years. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, there are ongoing mixed signals on whether the ANC has been talking to the MK party about political participation. So where do things stand now after last night's announcement that the ruling party is moving towards a government of national unity? From the MK party, Nhlamulo Ndlela joins us. He speaks for the party. And firstly, then, what is your take on the announcement from the ANC last night?
Look, I mean, we have been requested to engage in discussions with the ANC, of which we will. So, contrary to the misconceptions that were created, that we are not interested in engaging in discussions. Now, GNU, Government of National Unity, remember, was formed in 1994 off the back of violence and what was happening in the country at the time. And we see it as that. And quite honestly, let's be honest, the outcomes of even those negotiations that led to this constitution have not yielded, you know, the liberation of our people, more so also economically. So we've heard the use of terminology such as government of national unity, but we know that's coming from the DA, you know. And you know, Jeremy, what our position is with the DA, in as much as the DA's position has been very clear as it pertains to us. So, you know, what is a government of national unity? If I was to ask you, Do you understand what the conditions of that are? I'm sure you'd be find it quite sketchy yourself, wouldn't you?
Well, so, let me ask the questions. What I do want to know is you've said to me you're prepared to enter into some kind of conversation with the African National Congress. In what respect then, and what would you be bringing to the table if those talks take place?
Well, those talks are going to take place. The question is, you know, we've been invited to engage in those talks and those discussions. We're going in there to listen as to what it is that they want to achieve. Remember, we've continuously said that we want to engage with progressive parties that are patriotic and that are wanting to see change. And key to that is that, you know, we have policies, we have a policy position. We know that a lot of ANC's policies are like-minded and aligned to ours. But our concern is that a lot of their policies have not been implemented under the Cyril Ramaphosa-led government. And that's of concern. That's the first thing. We can't be engaging with an entity or an organization that's not going to implement the policies that ought to be liberating their people. So that's why we're saying that some of their policies are aligned to ours, right? So that's one. The other one is we've raised the issue of the Constitution, which continues to protect only the few. There are certain elements in the Constitution that need to be dealt with and changed. And we even mentioned the issue of, for instance, the Irrigation Act. People who received rights to have access to water, same rights that were issued by the apartheid government, which were then obviously carried over into this dispensation. So now that we want to, as a government, you know, institute water reforms, you know, people run up right up to this constitutional court and leverage this constitution that continues to protect them. You can't, as an individual, control a dam such as Jozini Dam whilst water ought to be used for sustainability.
Let me ask you this question. If you're going to enter into a conversation with the African National Congress, is there any compromise on your call for President Ramaphosa to be removed from the process before you become more involved?
Look, we need to sit and listen in, and we're going to obviously present our conditions and our position. And off the back of that, make a determination and a decision. At this point, we've made it very clear that we don't want to engage the ANC of Ramaphosa. And there's a reason for that, because the ANC of Ramaphosa, one we've always said, has been bought, and that's why it can't implement its policies. So we can't be engaging with people whose position are going to be us, you know, having to discuss points of order as opposed to just implementing. South Africans are tired of this.
The ANC's position, of course, is it's intractable on President Ramaphosa being removed. So does that not immediately equate to a stalemate?
Well, you know, engaging and dictating are two different things. Negotiating and dictating are two different positions here. You know, in as much as you ask me what is our position of compromise, the question is what is their position of compromise and to what extent? So, you know, we'll present our position and our conditions and we'll take it from there.
When exactly are these talks going to take place?
Well, we're going to be having discussions as at today. And then obviously those will span over a couple of days, I'd like to believe.
Who's going to sit in on those talks?
You mean from our side or
Correct.
Their side?
Well, I mean, if you know who's going to sit in on from their side, if there are any changes, I'd be interested. But the question is about from your side.
Well, I would not want to disclose right now, Jeremy, because I guess in a way it will give you a sense of what kind of angle we're pursuing here.
All right. Fair enough. I understand strategic and difficult times. Let me ask you this question then. Going forward, what role does your party envisage for former President Zuma?
Well, look, President Zuma is the president of the party. We've always wanted President Zuma to be president of the country, and you know that's always been the position. And more so off the back of the will of the people, that's what people are telling us. They want to see him lead. Now, again, that's a determination and a decision that will be made by President Zuma himself as to whether he wants to go to parliament or not, or wants to be president or not. He still stays as the president of the party. And that's that. Until then, you know, we'll make a determination.
I'm going to leave it there. And Tlamulo and Lela, thank you very much indeed. Speaking for the MK Party, I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So just to recap, in our program obviously dominated by politics today, late last night President Ramaphosa announcing the party's decision to invite other parties to form a government of national unity. All of this, of course, following the party's failure to secure more than 50% of the national vote in the May 29 election. I want to turn our attention now to commentator Sandile Swana. And going forward then, in your opinion, what is the likely process for the ANC's talks and other parties as they begin to build this GNU?
I think at a minimum, the ANC will want to have an in-principle agreement from a certain number of parties that they are willing to participate in the government of national unity. That will be the minimum, and that they are, you know, and at least agree on a election of the president, of which Ramaphosa will probably put up his name as the candidate. So that will be that, because, and I say that because discussions with MK, which I think the ANC is aware could be a problem, will happen probably after that, will be finalized after that. Then the cabinet seats will have to be split accordingly, because basically this affects the cabinet, how you form the cabinet. And then obviously the portfolio committees and so on, but mainly the cabinet.
What role do you see MK, if at all, playing in the GNU?
You know, I have, you might call me too much of a pluritarian or a liberal, but I have the view that in South Africa, we need to reach a stage where a communist can sit with a capitalist and a Muslim with a Jew and all that. So as long as people have been voted for, they must be given a chance to speak. Where decisions are made, they must have a seat at the table. As to the specific role, for instance, whether they'll be more useful in agriculture or being Minister of Public Works or whatever, I cannot answer that. But what I do believe, if you can have the EFF and the Freedom Front Plus in one room, it's better than them scattered in the community there without being in a structure. So that would be my view, that everybody who can be there must be put there and they must have their say.
Within the African National Congress itself and moving forward, do you think it's going to be difficult to deal with internal dissent, because we know that does still exist?
No, the internal dissent is very heavy, because, which is also speaks to the previous point we've just discussed now, because my judgment is that EFF has got supporters in the ANC, the DA has some supporters in the ANC, MK has got some supporters in the ANC. So if you are able somehow to channel all these people and their principles into the GNU, let's have the debate in the structure, and let's have the rules for the debate and the rules of how we're going to work together. The job, we've not yet even started discussing how the job is going to get done, because as you know, there are critics who've said that we don't even have a proper economic plan in South Africa and things like that. So there is work that needs to be done, but we need to silence the politics if there's ever such a thing.
Sandile, if you look at the major players, so the Democratic Alliance, the EFF, the IFP, the National Freedom Party, the Patriotic Alliance, do you think their strategy will be focusing on stability, which is critical, or simply chasing positions?
No, I don't think that it's going to be big about positions now. I think that all across the board, there is a recognition that, for instance, there's no majority party, so there's no senior brother and things like that. So let us then talk about the work. I think there is going to be a big argument about how do we develop the plan, which is not there. There is no plan of work in South Africa. And then let's allocate seats according to the best capable people, those sorts of things. The PA and the EFF have both made a decision that they want to be in government. I don't think they are going to get the biggest portfolios on first attempt. I doubt it. But they do want to be part of government now. So that is what the issue is going to be.
It's going to be difficult, though, once there is some degree of agreement for the ANC to manage ideological and political differences within GNU partners. But that's always the risk, isn't it?
It's always the risk. There are things that I think some people will have to, once it's, if it's a GNU, for instance, the issue about Israel and all that. If the GNU is formed properly, the issue on Israel will still have, the current position on Israel will still have more than 60% support in that government of national unity anyway. And the DA will have queries about BEE and about EE, but that position will also have 60% support. So I think the debate, real serious debate, will be about the modalities of how to get the economy off the ground, the technocratic type of aspect of the economy, rather than these ideological questions which have divided the nation as things stand. But unfortunately, the DA will not be able to sway those.
And just a final question. Why do you think the party eventually went for the GNU option instead of going into formal coalition exploration?
Obviously, there is what the Marxists call a balance of forces. There is a pressure that was already there from big business, that they want a government and a coalition that is friendly to business. And by that, what they meant was that they wanted a prominent role of the DA. On the other hand, you would have had uncontrollable rebellion from the EFF and MK if they were not accommodated, and rebellion inside the ANC. So a GNU says, generally, a formula for the GNU is already there. You just work out the votes and you give people system. Either they take them or they don't take them. Then it's not as if you discriminated intentionally against anybody. You are following what the voters have said. So it was a softer option for the ANC.
Sandile Swana, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, as we move on, let's pivot away from politics. And I suppose, though, if politicians want to stay sharp, they need to eat more fish. And in that respect, the number of overfished stocks globally has tripled in a half a century. And today, fully one-third of the world's assessed fisheries are currently pushed beyond their biological limits. Obviously, this has had an impact right down the commercial value chain, and new thinking is obviously necessary. So let's talk about one such strategy on World Oceans Day with Ocean Basket Supply Chain Executive Marco Coelho. The company has turned Marco into a, or has turned, should I say, to a small-scale fishing community or set of communities. So how has overfishing globally impacted the supply chain, and what risks then is this posing to business and being future fit?
So, I mean, overfishing is a reality that we've been dealing with for a while. And the biggest impact is the amount of seafood that actually goes to waste. This overfishing results in often the supply and demand being completely out of sync. And because this overfishing normally happens in very isolated areas, inadequate supply chains then result in this fish sitting in the incorrect conditions for extended period of time. From an ocean basket perspective, obviously the first thing for us when mitigating risk is to ensure that we've got long-term relationships with the correct suppliers, right? And that includes everything from sustainability, human practices, vessel inspections. And we never, ever buy from any factory, any farm, any vessel that we do not personally go and inspect. The second thing we do is obviously we have extensive planning mechanisms, which, unlike most other product, account for seasons, accounts for weather, and then obviously, you know, the demand that we see going through our restaurants. So it's a trifactor that we look at to ensure that we are buying the right fish at the right time from the right location, and then hopefully marry that back to the demand in our restaurants. And then the last thing we do is always ensure that our product mix is flexible. And this, again, allows us to shift between species because they may be under pressure. It may be the wrong season. It may be something that we want to introduce from a variety perspective. So those three factors are key to us mitigating the risk.
Also critical that you find the right partners, Marco, in terms of sustainability. And your organization has come together to look at a small-scale fishing community project. If I'm pronouncing this correctly, it's called Abalobi. What is that, and where is the benefit then for a community like that?
So Abalobi is a South African created tech solution, which is aimed at small scale fisheries. And really the foundation of that solution was to give small scale fishers the opportunity to track and then record the data that they normally don't have anywhere to keep track of. Having track and visibility of that data then allows the fishers to better plan how they go out and fish and what they go out and target, right? And from an ocean basket perspective, We met Abalobi back in 2017. They were grassroots. They weren't ready to talk to a big restaurant group. They were aiming it at small restaurants. And post those conversations, we got to a point where we realized that as Ocean Basket, that we could have a significant impact on the local fishing communities. And not only from a fish management perspective, but more importantly, from the way our relationship with Abalobi impacts on the communities. And that for us is probably the key driving factor in the relationship. We've been dealing with Abalobi for just over 2 years. And one of the metrics that we track is food security within the communities that we work. And over the last, I would say, 18 months, we've seen those communities increase their food security from around 55 to 60% to being 100% food secure. And there's a combination, obviously, of the commercial model as well as other things that we do in this partnership to ensure that food security remains in place.
And on the other side of the coin, what impact has this had on mitigating risk associated with bigger traditional fishing practice?
Look, Jeremy, I mean, for us as Ocean Basket, we are reliant on a short list of core products to maintain our offering to the consumer. And post-COVID, we realized that we needed to shift our supply chain from purely being volume driven to being more flexible and having a just-in-time aspect to it. So that's where Abalobi plays a massive role. We buy locally. The lead times are far shorter than any other product that we procure. That obviously leads to reduced costs of holding inventory. And obviously from a price perspective, we eliminate, you know, the dreaded rate of exchange, which affects every single other product that we deal in.
Given that they are small operators, is there a risk in terms of constant supply?
Initially there was. And I think, you know, that was their biggest concern, was making a commitment to Ocean Basket and then, you know, not being able to honor it. And the small scale fishermen, they really are committed, and the last thing they would want to do is disappoint. So over the last 18 months, we've slowly built a model where we initially started to hold backup stock, where we created enough space for the fishers to build up that backup stock. And over the 18 months, we've understood what the demand is. The data that Abalobi gathers through the application allows fishers then to obviously plan based on weather, catch conditions, etc. And on our side, with the demand planning tools that we have, we balance the two. And over the last 6 months, we are basically now operating on a just-in-time model, which for us, from a species such as sea bream perspective, is practically unheard of. But because of the data that we've gathered and the trends that we've seen, we've been able to execute on that.
Thank you very much for joining me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And let's finish the program with this. The 97th Comrades Marathon will be the 49th uprun on Sunday, starting at the Durban City Hall, ending at the Scottsville Racecourse in Pietermaritzburg. Starts at 5:30 in the morning, finishes 12 hours later, covering 85.91 kilometres. Let me tell you, it truly is one of the world's great sporting spectacles. Delaine Kulz is with us now, who is the marketing manager for Comrades. Delaine, welcome to you. What factors do you think then have contributed to this enduring popularity and prestige? 97 years. It's very, very impressive.
Good afternoon, Jeremy, to you and the listeners. Great to be with you. And yes, it is truly one of the, I mean, it is the ultimate human race in more ways than one. Over the years, I mean, it is a 103-year history of the Comrades Marathon, you know, starting from 34 starters back in 1921, took a dip after the World War II years. And, you know, now we had nearly 23,000 entrants. Over 20,500 runners on the start line on Sunday, having qualified fully to take on the 85.91 kilometer challenge, and also attracting 2,500 participants from 76 nations this year, all descending on KwaZulu-Natal. I mean, we love it, and the aim is to obviously keep it going as strong as we can. I mean, it's like today, this morning, we've just stepped out of the elite athletes media briefing, and the pedigree of athletes in this year's ultramarathon is second to none. you know, a stellar lineup of both South African and international athletes. It's not just the prestige of the Comrades Marathon, to a large extent, of course, I think runners know, you know, there's also a formidable prize purse up for grabs. I think most of the media were alerted to the announcement last week that the first prize for man and woman on Sunday has increased from the original CMA positioned first prize of 550,000 Rand to 825,000 Rand, thanks to a top-up from Cell C. And then with the incentives for breaking the uprun best time, the best pace on the uprun, the first South African man and woman, the first KwaZulu-Natal man and woman, if all of those criteria are met on the day, you could have the first man and woman running off with just over 2 million rand.
That is very, very impressive. You know, as you're talking to me, Delaine, I can't help but think 103 years ago, they weren't talking about technology and its integration into the planning and the execution of the event. And I guess no one was talking about steps to minimize the environmental impact of something like this.
Absolutely not, Jeremy. I mean, it's like back in the day, there was also, I mean, it's like you could win a tea set, you could win a flower bowl, you could run off with a silver medal, you know. I think it was 1983 when gold medals for the first six men and women back then, that was an offer. Now, besides the prize purse, you've also got a pure 1 ounce gold medal for each of the top 10 men and women. That's valued at just around 1.2 million rand for those 20 gold medals. Like you say, you know, technology, I mean, it's like, how far have the race numbers come from? 2 years ago, we published the comprehensive coffee table book of the Comrades Marathon in celebration of the centenary of the ultimate human race. And it documents really, really very pictorially how the race numbers, the medals, you know, have evolved over the years. And the same for technology. You know, now we've got previously you had to have a championship on your running shoe. Now it's all been integrated into the race bib. You know, we've got timing mats to also ensure that, you know, cheats don't make too much of a run for it on the day. And, you know, trying to keep the race as clean as possible, including all of the chaperones from SA Drug Free Sport to also ensure that, you know, the race is as clean and as ethical with the elites as we possibly can make it. And the same with all of the technologies, you know, from the start to the finish along the route. But more than that, Jeremy, the nicest thing is to hear from the internationals as to how they rate the Comrades Marathon. You know, more than a competitive race and as well as a recreational race. They speak about the runner's feast along the route. This year we've got 48 refreshment stations, you know, thanks to our sponsors and also a fair amount of budget that the CMA puts towards a lot of refreshments. We've got 2.2 million sachets of thirsty water along the route, 600,000 sachets of thirsty sports drink. You know, we've got tons of cooked potatoes, bananas, oranges, salty cracks biscuits.
Well, Delaney, if that's not enough to make people set their alarm for 5:30 on Sunday morning, then I don't know what is. Thank you so much for talking to me today. The marketing manager, full of energy and enthusiasm for the Comrades Marathon, Delaney Cools. Thank you indeed. Just before I go, on our last online poll, political talks continue. Confident, I asked, of an early outcome, a stalemate worry or too much mistrust, and the majority of our respondents yesterday saying they are still worried about doubt and suspicion. More politics today, a government of national unity in the offing. Best outcome, a long road ahead, or will be short-lived? I'm sure you've got a view on that. If you do, share your thoughts on our X and LinkedIn pages. That's it for this week. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays, and then up as a podcast. Have a good weekend. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Yeah.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.